It is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This really was a team effort. I couldn't have done it without Representative Becky Nutt, Representative Michelle Udall. And I think once the universities saw that there was such a groundswell of support by both caucuses, it finally passed. This is a huge win, in particular for some of our rural community colleges.
While there are many outstanding teachers in our schools, there are a handful that try to teach students what to think instead of how to think. Propaganda and one-sided political ideology should have no place in our classrooms.
It is not a controversial statement to say slavery was the cause of the Civil War and not an issue of states' rights. And yet those issues are going to be addressed. And it is certainly not controversial to say that President Biden was elected in a fair and secure election. And yet now we're going to have to both sides this.
We have been very concerned by the Senate's failure to properly prepare for this entire process. With the security of the ballots, the voting machines, and other election materials was immediately apparent upon transfer.
And with us to talk about the latest with the controversial ballot audit, attempts to restrict how teachers can approach certain subjects, and more, are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Emily, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
And former congressional staffer and attorney Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So, Roy, let's start off with what you're seeing as it relates to the Coliseum, specifically what the Department of Justice had to say. As you can imagine, I'm asking you to put your attorney hat on right now. Based on what the DOJ is saying, how much can the DOJ do right now, and do you agree with the concerns they've expressed?
Well, I do. I've had concerns from the very beginning of this audit, primarily at the beginning, concerns about why we were even doing the audit in the first place, because I felt as though, you know, the reason we were even entertaining this idea was based on false allegations about fraud in the election, which did not occur. But now we're seeing, you know, concerns from the Department of Justice that this audit could potentially be breaking federal law, specifically related to how the ballots are being secured in the particular location that they're at, which we've seen through news reports doesn't seem to be very secure. I mean, there's been reports about, you know, how ballots have just been left unattended, computers with information about ballots being left unattended, et cetera. So there are major concerns there. And then also, importantly, you know, the Department of Justice have pointed out concerns about potential voter intimidation if the auditors go forward with, you know, potentially directly trying to contact voters related to this so-called audit. So I have great concerns about it, and I imagine the Department of Justice is probably going to get even more involved in the coming weeks. That would be my prediction.
Emily, Roy laid out the concerns that a lot of people have. There are obviously people on the right, even Senate President Karen Fann, who doesn't have those same concerns, or at least not voicing them publicly. When you see what's going on there, you know, it seems like a circus to a lot of people, but is there anything worthwhile in this, or is it all as terrible as many people think?
You know, it's a bad situation. You know, I think President Fann, I know her. She and I don't always agree on everything, but she's a woman with a lot of integrity. And I do believe her when she says it was hard to find someone to do an audit. I've never seen this done before, so I'm sure that's true. And I also believe her when she says she hopes there's no fraud. I think that President Fann is not only responding to a constituency, but also a group of senators who, in a large majority, want something like that done. Now, that being said, the way the cyber ninjas have executed this is extremely disturbing. You know, I have no ninja training. I can't explain what they're down there doing. But, you know, it's a major risk to the voters, and I'm not just talking about independents and Democrats, conservative voters like myself. I am someone who's never missed an election, not even student council. I'm a solid conservative voter. I don't even like to answer census questions. When you're talking about candidates down there handling my secret ballot, candidates who appeared on that ballot, when you're talking about the government potentially sending someone to my home to speak to me about how I voted on that secret ballot, it feels very 1987 USSR, and it makes me not want to participate in the process. And that's a real risk to conservatives going forward.
Roy, you talked about the DOJ maybe getting more involved in this in the weeks to come. We should point out, though, that the lease at the Coliseum ends a week from today, and there really is some question about whether or where or if this can continue after that. Do you think that there's a certain amount of timeliness that the DOJ, if they're going to get involved in this, that they're going to try to stop it or do something, that they need to kind of get on this quickly?
Yeah, I mean, that has to be a concern. There's a lack of clarity, and I think Emily said it right in mentioning preparation here. I mean, it doesn't seem like there was preparation here by the auditors at all. There's been a failure to follow any sort of professional standards that, you know, election officials would use. And now we're at a point where they may not even have a venue to continue the count. And we've also seen, again, in news reports and from observers, that there could be a great amount of error rate in the kind of counting that they do. And that's even before getting to the question of whether they can finish the counting. And so I think, you know, there's a real concern about how this would even proceed a week from now. I think the department, if, you know, I used to work at the department, I imagine that they're very much watching this closely to see sort of what the next steps are going to be. And I think this letter that they sent a few days ago is just only the beginning of potentially getting involved.
So, Emily, when you talk about some of the reasons why Senate President Phan went forward with this, and whether or not she thought it was entirely necessary or not, that's probably something that is in her mind and maybe her mind alone. Given, as we just talked about, the fact that the lease ends next Friday and there really are questions about whether the Coliseum can still be the venue, and if not, what happens with all the stuff down there, is this in some way maybe an out for the president? Can she say, look, we did it all we could. We signed up this venue. They told us they'd be done in this amount of time. It's not. We got to pack it up.
You know, it would be a great out. But I don't know that the rest of the Senate, you know, it's not just up to President Phan. I don't know that that will be allowed. You've got state senators that don't want to move forward on a budget or sign or die for the year until this audit is completed, in case they want to take some legislative action based on the results. And in the meantime, you've got a group that's fundraising privately to continue this audit. You've got what's clearly becoming sort of a national political movement spawning from the audit and their Twitter account. I think it's sort of taken on a life of its own. I don't know that it can be stopped at this point.
Emily, let me ask you quickly about what you just said about some senators maybe don't want to move forward on the budget. There doesn't seem to be any indication that by July 1st, the report from the audit will be done. Even if the audit itself is done, it's going to take some time to compile the data and produce the report. Are we looking at a situation where senators might hold off on a budget into the new fiscal year because this isn't done?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's been done before. In 2009, we crossed that threshold of the new fiscal year deadline, and there nothing happened. You know, it was just a bunch of budgetary patches and things done to limp along, and I can see that happening again this year.
Roy, there are always worst case scenarios with these things, but going back to Senate President Phan, she was on with Ted on Horizon earlier this week and said something about, you know, there are 48% of Arizonans approximately who have concerns about how the election was carried out. So we hear that. We also hear that, you know, Katie Hobbs, Secretary of State, expressed her concerns last night about whether the cyber ninjas could just be using Arizona as a template to do this in other parts of the country. How alarming is that to hear? Because, again, for a lot of people, these are not exactly shining moments in electoral history in the United States. And could these things be used in other places? And is the argument that, well, maybe 48%, because a huge percentage of Republicans still say they support Donald Trump?
I mean, it's incredibly alarming to me. The precedent that this potentially could set is something that I was concerned with at the beginning when this was before a judge is, you know, are we, if this is allowed to go forward, are we going to see this after every election? And I'm scared that that is going to be the new reality, and certainly in maybe in other jurisdictions bringing this thing, you know, as a common practice. So it's very, very concerning to me. And it's concerning primarily because what is damaging here, and you mentioned the sort of 48%. I mean, there's a sizable chunk of, you know, particularly the Republican base that, you know, has doubts about what occurred in the election. And that is caused primarily by certain folks like former President Trump and others sort of fanning the flames with these false allegations. And so what concerns me at the end of the day is an erosion in trust of our democratic system by anybody. You know, we should all sort of believe in the security of our elections, the accuracy of our elections. That's important. It's a bedrock to our democracy. So anything that calls into question that confidence, especially for reasons that are unjustified, is very, very concerning to me. And I hope, I mean, I want to be optimistic and say, you know, at some point, you know, Republicans will accept the results of November and we can move on. And if Democrats lose the next time, we accept those results. I'd like to believe that. But it's certainly concerning that we're dealing with this now, and it may be dealing with this in the future.
Emily, a few minutes ago, you described yourself as a conservative, and I guess I can call him your boss, your colleague, Mr. Barnes, one of our favorites, is someone who embraces the process, always talks about that. And yes, he has certain points of view, but thinks our system is wonderful and is very enthusiastic about it. You've always struck me as someone like that, too. How discouraging is this to you that it could go in this direction, regardless of what party someone's in?
Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to ask me to counter my boss there for a second. That's not good for business.
As long as you're not wearing leather boots, no, that's okay.
You know, I think it's very concerning. Like I said earlier, you know, it makes me not want to participate in the process. I don't like any of this. This all feels like the kind of thing that once upon a time we would send Americans in to another country to make sure this wasn't happening. I get the need for accuracy and auditing and wanting to restore confidence to the percentage of the Republican Party that believes there was wide-scale fraud. I do understand that, but this is not instilling confidence. You know, we're just auditing Maricopa County. We're just looking at the U.S. Senate and the presidential race. We're not auditing all the Republican races where Republicans won. It just doesn't feel thorough enough or professional enough to do what it's setting out to accomplish. And I'm worried it's going to do more damage to both progressive and conservative voters.
Emily, I wanted to ask you about that because I'm wondering if you think that depending on, of course, what the audit finds and what actions, if any, the legislature takes as a result of it, is it possible that this could ultimately just cause conservatives to lose faith in the system and to stop showing up, which would, in theory at least, be to the benefit of the Democrats?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are some Democratic strategists somewhere in our state right now that are sort of delighted watching this, and they will cash in on this. And that's the thing that I'm worried about, is there's a vocal group in the Republican wing, and I don't want to dismiss them, but they're concerned about the integrity of the last election. Putting that aside and saying that's valid, there's also a group of Republicans, 24,000, that have left the Republican Party since the insurrection in January. There are also Republicans who remain registered Republicans that don't like what they're seeing. You know, this is further dividing up the conservative wing. But, you know, I think it's sort of been hijacked by the loudest group, which, you know, that tends to happen in politics.
Our guests today are Emily Ryan of Copper States Consulting and attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, some interesting moves, some would say. Republican House decided earlier this week to, in essence, punish some teachers who don't present both sides of some controversial arguments, and that got some Democratic lawmakers concerned about the Civil War, slavery, the Holocaust, 9/11, things like that. What do you make of this move by the House?
Well, I mean, I think it was disappointing. I'm concerned about the bill. I mean, this idea of giving equal weight to divisive topics, the language of the bill itself is very vague. And so it's a bit unclear what exactly that means, because there are topics like racism, for example, where I don't really believe that there's sort of equal weight. There's a both sides to that. And so it's a bit concerning to me that you couldn't present an issue like that in a way that's accurate. And secondarily, you know, I don't really understand, again, and this is somewhat of a theme with some of the legislation that's being passed this session, of really, you know, why we're actually doing this. Like, what is the problem? Because I don't think that teachers are going out there, you know, teaching curriculum that is biased. And so the fact that this bill is essentially going to police them, potentially fine them for talking about divisive topics like race and the history of this country and class and things like that, I just don't see why we need to do that. So it's very concerning to me. And you know, and also at the end of the day, I mean, I'm all for sort of accurate discourse. And I think this potential or this legislation could result in us not being honest about our country's history and the society we live in, which I think is a detriment to our students.
Emily, this may not be on parallel tracks, but there are some who've wondered whether this is some sort of punishment of teachers who, when it comes to teachers unions, tend to be more left. And then others will say, well, we already have a huge teacher shortage. We have some unqualified teachers or concerns that they are unqualified. Does this sort of send a poor message to educators in the state and people who may want to come here and help us end this teacher shortage?
You know, I suppose it could, but I don't think that's the goal of the legislation. I think the goal of the legislation, you know, and you have to understand there is a longstanding, deep-rooted, conservative suspicion, belief that there's a certain amount of liberal slant to the way historic events are taught in school, especially at the university level, which also tends to be kind of the more liberal time in all of our lives at that age. But that's been a longstanding thing. That's not a new thing. That's not a punishment for Red Fred. I don't really think there's a tie there. I think this is coming from parental concerns that they don't want their children taught their teacher's point of view. And so when you get into controversial topics, they want fact-based education and both sides presented. And I really believe that's the motive behind it.
Emily, is it concerning at all that what is and is not controversial is really not defined? Like, do you think that was an intentional thing, or is that just one of those things that you can't define?
I think it's one of those things you can't define. And, you know, I don't know that this legislation will entirely accomplish what they set out to do. You know, we'll have to see, as with everything that passes down there, you see how it is implemented in the real world. But yeah, that's a really, it's going to be a tough thing to define. It's going to be a tough thing to enforce.
Roy, we should point out that the bill still has to go back to the Senate before it goes to the governor. We've seen this week, obviously, some education groups come out and, you know, urging people to, you know, call their legislators and tell them to vote against it. Do you anticipate a pretty heavy lobbying effort both in the Senate and, assuming it passes the Senate and goes to the governor, pretty heavy lobbying effort on the governor on this?
I think there will be. And again, it has to do with the idea that teachers can be fined over this and that they'd be policed that way. So certainly, I think you know, the groups advocating for teachers unions, et cetera, will be bothered by this and advocate against it. But then also, again, because of the vagueness of the bill, we could be in a situation where, you know, our children can't be taught certain things about, again, you know, race, ethnicity, you know, the history of the country, the sort of current society we live in, and all of that would potentially be, you know, really to their own detriment. And so I think there's going to be concerns about that. And again, I'll sort of end it with what I sort of mentioned before, which is this seems to, again, be a solution in search of a problem, because I don't think the kind of curriculum that this bill to sort of take the sponsors at their honest word are concerned with is actually really going on.
Roy, earlier this week, the governor took some action rescinding an order he signed last year related to requirements for people who are getting unemployment benefits. We saw the national jobs report today, which was pretty tepid. Could be because more people are looking for work, but that hasn't been quite determined yet. What sort of changes do you think this could bring about, if any, for the state economy? What does it tell you about the way the governor is thinking as it relates to unemployment benefits generally? We've seen another bill that had some momentum. Representative David Cook was pushing for it to increase unemployment benefits. Where do you see all this in terms of the overall scope of economic impact on workers in Arizona?
Well, I kind of go back to what you just mentioned. And we had a jobs report this morning that I think was well below expectations. There may be some explanations for that, but it certainly is not what we expected. And I think that may show that the economy is still recovering from COVID and everything, the sort of economic crisis that resulted from that. So there are still a lot of people that are unemployed and that are searching for jobs and are hurting economically, which is why, you know, there have been proposals to increase, you know, the very low unemployment benefits that we offer in this state. So adding any additional requirements kind of gets back to this whole idea that there are people somehow taking advantage of the unemployment system, which, you know, studies have shown is just not true. So I'm not sure why changing the rules at this point is really necessary, because at the end of the day, you know, we have this system to help people that are struggling. And I think there are plenty of people that are still struggling.
Now, Emily, many on the right will say that the federal unemployment benefits, that addition, is actually discouraging people from going to work, at least in certain jobs. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think it's a little bit more complicated than just the benefits, because we are still in this pandemic. You know, the thought process behind the government closed a lot of businesses, and so the extra requirement was lifted. Now government's opened it back up, so let's get people back to work and put that requirement in. I think businesses are really happy about that. I think businesses are happy about the bill to limit employer liability due to COVID in the workplace, and I think the governor's going to have a lot of business support on signing the bill to prevent mask mandates. But I think to just put everyone in a bucket and say that everyone not working right now just wants to collect unemployment benefits is really short-sighted. There are still a lot of people that are concerned for their safety depending on their work environment or the industry that they're in. And I think there's an opportunity here for the governor to do something to help the workforce feel more safe about returning to work. And I think employers would start to see it be a little bit easier to hire and find the right people to fill those jobs.
Roy, let me ask you about something that is kind of becoming an every 2 year tradition here in Arizona, which is the effort to put a ballot initiative before voters that would stop dark money. This week, the latest version of that initiative was launched. We keep hearing that if it could actually make the ballot and go before voters, that, you know, supporters say it would easily pass. Is that a theory you subscribe to as well?
I think so. I mean, the public opinion polling that I have seen for years now on the idea of like campaign finance disclosure has always shown that there's broad support for that idea. And so I think that if it were able to get on the ballot, unless something has changed since the last time, I think it would probably pass because there is, and that I think is even on a bipartisan level, because I do think that people on both sides of the aisle look at the amount of money that's spent on politics and generally believe that knowing who's spending it is a good idea. And of course, I'm saying this as a campaign finance lawyer, and so it's probably against my own job to be saying this, but I think that's where most people are at. And if we talk about, again, sort of what's healthy for democracy, I think that is probably healthier for democracy to sort of shed light on political spending.
So, Emily, you mentioned the business community supporting some of the things that the governor is doing. In the past, this has not been an issue that the business community has been supportive of. Let's say that this year it actually, or next year it actually does make it onto the ballot and stays on the ballot. Does this rise to the level of threat to the business community where they would maybe put big bucks into trying to defeat it?
Oh, I think it will definitely be a big money campaign. I think it has been before. But I do agree that, you know, the odds are in favor of it passing in 2022, because I think when this started off, you know, a lot of people didn't really even understand the concept of dark money. I think everyone's got a solid grip on it now. And, you know, it's got a good chance of passing if it's on the ballot, but there'll be a lot of money spent against it.
Roy, are the same arguments out there to stop dark money, the idea that, you know, we just want more disclosure, and if someone isn't disclosing, maybe they've got something more to hide?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one of the arguments. There's also sort of an argument that, you're as an elected official, you're sort of beholden to the interests that support you with either campaign contributions or independent expenditures. So knowing who that is will, you know, allow you to sort of better judge what kind of elected official you're going to get when you're voting for a person. So, you know, those arguments are made. I think, you know, the larger problem, if we're talking about campaign finance, is probably the amount of spending and the unlimited spending that's been allowed since Citizens United. That's the larger problem if we're talking about corruption and sort of, you know, again, sort of damages to our democracy. That is not going to change, right? I mean, Citizens United is what it is right now, and barring some change from the Supreme Court on that, you know, the amount of spending is not going to change. So sort of the second best thing, I think, is this idea of shedding light on who is actually spending the money so that voters can make an informed decision.
And Emily, in our last 30 seconds or so, we're going to have another huge U.S. Senate race in Arizona in 2022. A couple of big businessmen who a lot of us have never heard of are running. How many candidates do you expect to see? Do you expect to see some conventional politicians and then some of these people with lots of money?
Oh, I think so. You'll see a lot of self-funded people and a lot of our ambitious politicos that we're used to seeing around. It's going to be tough to beat Mark Kelly. His presidential fundraising numbers, yeah, it's just going to be hard to beat the astronaut. If he plays it smart and casts smart votes, he's going to be tough to beat.
Emily Ryan, Copper State Consulting. Roy Herrera. Guys, thanks as always.
Thank you.